Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are going to be talking about a lot of very important stuff today, but perhaps nothing as important as what is developing with respect to the threat to freedom that is uniquely posed by the Chinese Communist Party. We have a lot of moving parts at the moment, assessing what is involved at the moment with respect to the party, its ambitions in the region and beyond, and its growing capability to act on those ambitions, perhaps at our mortal expense, as well as that of others, notably the people of Taiwan. A man who is deeply knowledgeable about all of these subjects, a regular here, I'm very pleased to say, at Securing America, also one of my friends and colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is the co-author with Yan Chao Han of an important new book, Understanding the China Threat, as well as a very, very active contributor to the public policy debate in outlets like the Epoch Times and The Hill. Brad Thayer, welcome back to Securing America, sir. It's good to have you with us, and thank you for bringing your expertise to bear on a lot of very dynamic developments of late.
Thank you, Frank. I'm very pleased to join you, and congratulations on the new book, The Indictment, which I understand is available through at Amazon for purchase, and that really lays out the account of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, as a transnational criminal organization. So, well, excellent work.
In fact, thank you, and it's part of what we'll be talking about here this morning. Brad, let me just ask you, for starters, we've had Tsai, president of Taiwan, in the United States now for several days. She has been meeting and will be meeting with senior elected officials, including the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. One of her predecessors in that position of president of Taiwan, a fellow by the name of Ma, has been making his own visit abroad, as it happens, to China on the mainland. The Chinese Communist Party has feted him. And the question is, as Taiwan both moves towards elections in the next few months, or early next year, I guess I should say, but also as China is amping up its threats to the island, what do you make of these sort of competing visits and what's going on in the course of them?
Well, Frank, it's both visits are very important, as you noted. What we're witnessing is a cleavage in Taiwanese politics between those supporting Tsai and the Democratic People's Party, who are very interested in maintaining, of course, improving relations with the United States, and Ma representing a wing of the KMT, or the Chinese Nationalist Party, the remnant party that fled to Taiwan in 1949 with Chiang Kai-shek at that time.
And which was virulently anti-communist, as I recall.
Indeed, and there are still strong anti-communist elements within the KMT, but Ma is representing a faction which is not, and his visit to the mainland, to China, under the CCP is an important signal that opinion in Taiwan, at least at the elite party level, is in tension, that there are still some who would seek to have a positive relationship with the Chinese Communist Party. Thankfully, those are in the minority. And most Taiwanese recognize, of course, that they do not want to fall under the shadow and certainly not under the control of the Chinese Communist Party. But there is that division there of which Americans should be aware, and of course, which makes the defense of Taiwan a bit more complicated, because there would be Taiwanese who see unification, which was the intent originally as devised by the KMT, and that was that China was temporarily divided, the KMT would return to the mainland and rule once again, once the communists had been defeated. So that sentiment and that fundamental political principle still remains. It's atrophied, it's weakened, as the KMT recognizes, of course, that the CCP is a profound danger to Taiwan. But nonetheless, there are elements that still support that.
Yeah, but unification on the Chinese Communist Party's terms is the difference from, you know, Chiang Kai-shek's vision, as Mark Twain famously put it, between lightning and lightning bugs.
Well,
you're going to see them enslaved, not ruling China, and in the process liberating, hopefully, the people there from the Chinese Communist Party. So talk about all of this in the context now of these conversations that Tsai has been having and will in the course of the day with the leadership of our country, not so much the administration, I guess, but members of Congress, the United States Senate. How is this being perceived, both on the island of Taiwan as well as by the mainland, by the Chinese Communist Party? Are we likely to see more of the kind of, ratcheting up, intensifying threats, military responses that we did when Speaker Pelosi met with Tsai last year?
Indeed, there's always that potential. The Chinese Communist Party hates this because they maintain the fiction that Taiwan is part of China and that this is a renegade province. So Tsai has no business meeting with Kevin McCarthy in Los Angeles, as she's scheduled to do. It's a very positive step that McCarthy is meeting with her and conveying support, congressional support for her. That signals that the United States has a national security interest in Taiwan, which in fact it does for economic reasons. Taiwan is a chip producer, for example. For geostrategic reasons, a critical island nation that so close to China and maintaining an island chain from Japan through the Philippines. And then, of course, for political reasons, because Taiwan works. Democracy in Taiwan works, and that's an existential threat to the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, who know that they're illegitimate, and so look at Taiwan as, of course, a symbol of ideological threat, what China should and hopefully will once again become. So,
and what is possible if the Chinese people are given freedom in terms of their prosperity as well as their enjoyment of those liberties that are denied the people on the island, the mainland of China.
Indeed, and McCarthy's visit is a symbol that the United States is standing with Taiwan. And let's hope that there are additional measures in this regard. Ultimately, recognition, diplomatic recognition of Taiwan as an independent state is what we would hope is in the cards at some point. But McCarthy, it's a very important symbol that the American people through Congress are standing with Taiwan. It also needles the CCP, right? Very important. The Biden administration has been weak in political warfare for reasons we've discussed, that there is not the leadership that we want to have in this regard. So it falls to the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, to do this.
Let me just say, we have to take a short break here before we do. Putting it charitably, the administration has been weak in the space of political warfare. I would argue, if anything, Joe Biden and his subordinates have been batting for the other team in that political warfare. And unfortunately, that's why these visits are so vital, is that it's sending a different signal than the one that the administration has been mostly communicating of appeasement and acquiescence. Hold the thought. We'll be right back with much more with Dr. Bradley Thayer of the Center for Security Policy right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Mexico's hard-left president, Manuel López Obrador, has written Chinese Communist dictator Xi Jinping asking for help with the burgeoning trafficking of the murderous synthetic opioid known as fentanyl. That's like asking an arsonist to help fight fires he's setting. In fact, Xi's regime has long actively enabled what amounts to chemical warfare against the United States. These days, that's primarily being done by the Chinese Communist Party allowing the shipment of the drug's precursor chemicals to be assembled and smuggled across our border in immense quantities by Mexican drug cartels. The Chinese also help lubricate the operation by laundering its windfall profits. Like the cartels, the CCP is a transnational criminal organization. It must be prosecuted as such, the subject of my new book, The Indictment, not legitimated or otherwise invited to expand its presence in Mexico's incipient failed state. This is Frank Affney. We're back. We are visiting with the director of the China program at our Center for Security Policy, Dr. Bradley Thayer, the co-author with Liangqiao Han of a really important new book I commend to you. He's kind enough to mention The Indictment. You can also buy Understanding the China Threat at Amazon and in bookstores everywhere. A very important and very timely work, especially at a moment when we're trying to figure out the way ahead here with respect to what China clearly has in mind for Taiwan, which is unification, but what they may well have in mind for us, as they see us ultimately as the impediment to the realization of their ambitions to be, once again, the center of the universe, as they're fond of saying. And Brad, in that regard, just crystal ball gazing here, what is your current expectation about how the Chinese will respond if, once again, they are upset by these kinds of evidences, at least from our legislative branch, if not the executive, that we do stand with the people of Taiwan against the CCP's predations?
Well, they always send a coercive signal when these events occur, as they did in August when Pelosi visited Taiwan in person. So what we should expect is that there will be coercive signals. There'll be more penetrations of Taiwanese airspace and of sea space. There'll be the usual aspects of public diplomacy and declarations from the Chinese government and from party leadership. And we might see that they actually take an additional measure this time because they recognize that with Biden as president, now is the time to conquer Taiwan. Now is the time to aggress against Taiwan and conquer it. And so these measures that might be taken might include additional missile tests, which they have done as a consistent element of signaling their displeasure going back to 95 and 96. Frank, I know you remember those, third Taiwan Straits crisis, the fourth we had last year, and we should expect potentially a fifth now. They'll also start to single really how they're going to blockade Taiwan, which is going to be a key aspect. So we should expect their maritime militia, their Coast Guard, and then, of course, People's Liberation Army Navy to be in full force around Taiwan.
And the thing that's so concerning about all of this, Brad, is, as you know so well, when the Chinese keep stretching the envelope, if you will, in these various ways, they're putting themselves in a position basically at any moment to actually close the trap, to move against Taiwan with essentially no warning at all. To the extent that this is a matter of, I think, strategic importance for the reasons you discussed in the last segment, it behooves us to be standing more palpably with the people of Taiwan, notably by ensuring that they have access to the kinds of military capabilities that are needed to deter the Chinese from engaging in such behavior, and of course bringing our own deterrent to bear as well. There's a lot of concern, and I share it, that we are seeing the administration continue to migrate a lot of that military equipment, including from our own stocks now, to not Taiwan, but to Ukraine. Your thoughts on what's going on in that regard and its advisability, right there.
Well, Frank, two big points there. First would be that the Chinese are doing their utmost to signal us that they will escalate. The spy balloon is the classic case of it was certainly collecting intelligence, but it was also a political message sent to the American people that China can reach out and touch the American homeland and kill Americans. That was the message of the spy balloon, and a very chilling one, but one which, of course, to which we need to respond when they do something like that.
I want to come back to that topic in a moment, but on this question of Taiwan and arming.
On the second point, which is also very large, there's simply not enough to go around. We're not producing enough because our industries have been not pulsed. They have not been, if you will, spun up to produce the military kit that we need to have to deal with all of the contingencies that we face in international politics. Helping Taiwan is a key aspect of that. And so the Biden administration, when hard choices have to be made, prefer Ukraine to Taiwan. That weakens our deterrent. If there's not enough to go around, where you send material signals your priority. And the priority is Ukraine rather than Taiwan, and that's damaging for deterrence.
Yeah. And Brad, you know, as you were talking, I'm just thinking that the administration is doing this in the context of all of these other signals that it's sending of acquiescence and accommodation, appeasement, elite capture, for that matter, a subject very much on the minds of both of us in our respective books. But I just wonder whether, especially at a moment such as this, that kind of prioritization is not actually incentivizing the Chinese to think they can have their way with the Taiwanese, as does the response to the balloon. And Brad, one of the things I wanted to specifically address with you is we've seen of late reporting that the Chinese actually got exactly what they wanted, as best we can tell, from their penetration of our airspace. In addition, of course, to the signal sending, the communicating of a real and present threat to harm us. But just in terms of the intelligence collection purposes that the balloon, you know, was configured for, what can you tell us about all of that? And the feckless way in which the Biden team responded to it.
Well, it is clear with subsequent reporting, the NBC News report and then the follow-on reports, that the balloon was a spectacular success. It sent the political message that they wanted to send. It was a very
useful success, that is, for the Chinese Communist Party.
Correct, for the Chinese Communist Party. It was a humiliation for us. It was something which should never have happened, but nonetheless did. So it was a success for the Chinese Communist Party in that it sent the right political warfare messages. It also was collecting intelligence throughout its mission, which was valuable because there was long loiter time. And so the collection that they would have gained would be different from what they would get through essentially signals intelligence satellites, which the Chinese possess. So it was an intelligence.
Or photographic ones or what have you. But Brad, I guess
for us, but then it reminds me of Eisenhower's, where with the U-2 shoot down and they leaked, the cover story was that it was essentially a weather a mission that was lost and penetrated Soviet airspace. And then, of course, the Eisenhower administration came out. The Soviets said the pilot was alive, right? So the lie kept getting worse. So this is exactly what we're having. The lies, the dissemination from the administration are being revealed, in fact, that it is far worse. And the fact that we could not shoot, there's still ambiguity whether we shot it down with an AIM-9X air-to-air missile, or whether the Chinese detonated themselves. This type of ambiguity and fecklessness it weakens our credibility. Deterrence is a function of military capabilities and political variables like credibility and commitment.
And let me just drill down on that. We're almost out of time, Brad, but a final point, I guess, is You mentioned that the balloon loitered. What the administration did not acknowledge at the time was that it was actually, apparently, doing figure eights over some of the most sensitive sites in the United States so as to, yes, loiter and collect more intelligence over time. All the more reason why it should have been taken down far before when it did, and especially if it, in the end, we didn't take it down. It was self-destructed, all the worse. Deterrence is about, you know, the persuasiveness of your determination to resist aggression, and we're not signaling that very well. Brad Thayer, thank you as always for joining us and for your insights. It's so appreciated. Keep up the great work that you do at the Center for Security Policy. Godspeed. We'll talk to you soon. We'll be right back with more with Reggie Littlejohn right after this.
Night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. She has risen from her sick bed, praise God, and is with us to talk about an important new project that we're partnering up on, as we often do. Her name is Reggie Littlejohn. She is the founder and president of a marvelous organization, Women's Rights Without Frontiers. She is also spearheading a new coalition. It's called the Sovereignty Coalition, that is designed to raise awareness about and try to effect some corrective actions concerning the prospect that our sovereignty will be destroyed by, well, the connivance of the Biden administration and the World Health Organization and others that would essentially entrust to the WHO decisions about American public health policy. Reggie, it's great to have you back. Welcome and thank you. Congratulations on this new endeavor. I'm so proud to be participating in it with you and to hear a little bit and share with our audience an event that, as we speak, is in prospect, as this program airs, will have been accomplished, we hope. Talk about the launch of this new coalition and its new declaration.
So the coalition is called the Sovereignty Coalition. Sovereignty refers to our national sovereignty that is going to be injured or destroyed if these World Health Organization agreements are passed, and if the United States is going to actually be a part of the World Health Organization. So that's national sovereignty. We can unpack that. And then also our personal sovereignty, our personal medical freedom, which will be directly impacted by these World Health Organization accords, they're calling them. They're really treaties, but they're calling them accords so that they can avoid the treaty process of the United States Senate and all the other legislatures of the world. So,
But unfortunately, the United States Senate seems to be quite happy to be ignored in this process. And I just speak as an attorney and, you know, very accomplished litigator. what it means to our sovereignty, among other things, if the constitutional check and balance, the quality control mechanism of the Senate is not operating here.
Frank, this is really heartbreaking. Okay, so Ron Johnson sponsored a bill in the Senate saying any accord by the World Health Organization that's going to impact our sovereignty has got to be passed by the Senate. And the Senate voted it down. And it went straight
party
down
line vote.
Straight down party lines. And so then Ron Johnson posted on Twitter, "I'm so sorry to see that the Democrats don't care about our national sovereignty." And I hate to say it, but that's what it looks like, okay?
It sure does.
I mean, so many people...
Now, Reggie, let me just ask you, just define this term sovereignty for those of us who are not
national sovereignty is what we're talking about right now. That means that the United States, as a sovereign nation, gets to decide how we handle our own internal affairs. That's a big part of it. So if this World Health Organization accord passes, which we expect it to, we can't stop things that happen at the World Health Assembly. And if it's implemented by the United States, the World Health Organization and Dr. Tedros, who has a terrible background with communism and is very deeply aligned with Xi Jinping, the Chinese Communist Party, they will dictate our healthcare in case of a pandemic or a potential pandemic. So that could be anything. They can say,
or worse, Reggie, not even a pandemic, just a public health emergency of international concern, so-called.
Even a potential one. So I mean, and not only for humans, but under One Health, if it's for humans, animals, plants, the environment. I mean, basically, it would make the World Health Organization and Dr. Tedros the most powerful person in the world. And so the impact on our national sovereignty is that the World Health Organization will be able to say, this is how we want you to handle whatever it is in your land. So we want you to quarantine. We want you to lock down. We want you to force everybody to have a mask. And they could even say, we want you to force vaccinations. That would be within their power.
Yeah. But also, if they call, for example, gun violence,
right,
a public health crisis of internet or emergency of international concern, could they actually be, mandating that there be new arms, gun control arrangements put into place, or even the seizure of guns from America?
So, Frank, this is the thing. All right, that would be unconstitutional, right?
Right.
But that doesn't mean it won't happen. Because if you have people who hate the Constitution or who ignore the Constitution in power, they can enforce it.
Yeah. And one, if you're cynical, and unfortunately I have become rather cynical about the Biden administration, if, as the president is incessantly saying, he wants to grab those weapons of war, those semi-automatic rifles, for example, that he takes such pride in having banned once upon a time in the United States Senate. But he can't get it done the normal way, the constitutional way, but he could get it done through this bank shot. Do you think that you could put that past him?
Oh, no, I wouldn't put it past him. And that's exactly right, Frank. Okay, there's things that the globalists in our government want to do to us that they can't do to us as our government. So what they're doing is they're looking to the World Health Organization to do it for them. And then they invoke these emergency powers, which should not suspend our constitutional rights, but they have been using them as an excuse to suspend our constitutional rights. And if we don't fight back, they're just going to roll right over us.
Right. And Reggie, you've spent most of your professional life, to your great credit, with Women's Rights Without Frontiers, especially, trying to help the people of China,
right,
who have been suffering unbelievably at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. I've written a new book, as you know, called The Indictment, about, among other things, the crimes against humanity of the Chinese Communist Party against its own people and what they would do to us as well, of course. Talk about the role of the Chinese Communist Party in this attack on our sovereignty. You mentioned the relationship between Tedros and the CCP, but would they likely be able to benefit from the kind of empowerment that you're talking about here?
Oh, they're the total beneficiaries of this, Frank. So this is the China model. And something that we haven't touched on yet is the surveillance state that these World Health Organization accords would establish. So right in there, there's the International Health Regulations Amendments, and then there's a pandemic treaty, which they're not calling a treaty. You put them together. What they do is they establish the monitoring of every person, then the platform that they would use for these digital health IDs or vaccine passports is the same as what China is using for the social credit system. So they're going to be monitoring people, and they're also going to be censoring people. So there's something in the accord that calls for nations to censor misinformation and disinformation, which is actually the truth in a lot of cases, but it's just whatever the World Health Organization is not saying. That's going to be, so they could establish the China social credit system in the United States, tool of surveillance and totalitarian control. And if you combine that with a central bank digital currency where they can cut off our funds if they don't like us, then we are trapped. We have to fight this.
And Reggie, the thing about this is that, as you know so well, we're not just making this up. We've actually been subjected to a sort of test run of all of these kinds of China model and their repercussions for our freedoms, as well as for our economy and, you know, our country. And that was when the World Health Organization simply had advisory powers, not mandatory ones. I just can't imagine what this would look like if this fellow, Tedros Ghebreyesus, a proxy or puppet of the Chinese Communist Party, is entrusted with the authorities that you're describing here. What can be done by American citizens to oppose what's now in the offing, and in particular tie into this work of the New Sovereignty Coalition?
The United States needs to withdraw from the World Health Organization. It is a corrupt globalist organization that is set on taking over our national sovereignty and our personal medical freedom. And we can't stop these accords from being approved, because it's being approved by the World Health Assembly. We only have one vote as one country out of 194 at the World Health Assembly. We're not going to be able to stop it. The only way
we don't have a veto, just like the UN General Assembly.
So the only way that we can stop it is by withdrawing. So that's what the Sovereignty Coalition is about. So it's sovereigntycoalition.org, sovereigntycoalition.org. That's the website. Please go on there and sign our declaration saying that we want to preserve U.S. sovereignty, preserve our personal medical freedom, oppose forced vaccination.
Vaccine passports,
the whole thing. Sign the declaration. We need thousands, tens of thousands, millions of people to sign this, because that's the only way that we're going to be able to go to the government and say, you know, the political will exists for us to withdraw from the World Health Organization.
And in fact, it's not just political will. It is the demand of the American people that we preserve our republic in the face of this clear and present effort to take it down. Reggie Littlejohn, as always, I admire your work and so appreciate what you're doing in connection with the Sovereignty Coalition, sovereigntycoalition.org. Folks, please check it out. Sign up. Become part of the solution. Reggie, we'll talk with you again very soon. Stay tuned for more right after this, Securing America. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Mexico's hard-left president, Manuel López Obrador, has written Chinese communist dictator Xi Jinping asking for help with the burgeoning trafficking of the murderous synthetic opioid known as fentanyl. That's like asking an arsonist to help fight fires he's setting. In fact, Xi's regime has long actively enabled what amounts to chemical warfare against the United States. These days, that's primarily being done by the Chinese Communist Party allowing the shipment of the drug's precursor chemicals to be assembled and smuggled across our border in immense quantities by Mexican drug cartels. The Chinese also help lubricate the operation by laundering its windfall profits. Like the cartels, the CCP is a transnational criminal organization. It must be prosecuted as such, the subject of my new book, The Indictment, not legitimated or otherwise invited to expand its presence in Mexico's incipient failed state. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and I'm always delighted to be able to say Robert Spencer is in the house. Robert is the founder and driving force behind a remarkable product, online resource, and bellwether, really, of much of what is going on in the space that is described by the title of his product, Jihad Watch. Jihadwatch.org is where you can find it. It is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Its director, Robert Spencer, is a man of letters of considerable accomplishment. 24 books, I'm thinking, at the moment, to his credit, including several done for the Center for Security Policy Press, including Who Lost Afghanistan? Robert is one of our regulars here at Securing America. We're always delighted to have him with us, and especially to take stock of what both the Islamists, of course, the Sharia supremacists, as I'm inclined to call them, and their friends on the left are up to. And this brings to mind, Robert, something you've reported on, an attack by the Islamic State, better known as ISIS, in Vancouver, Canada, recently. It had not gotten a lot of attention that I'm aware of. Tell us a bit about it and what you think it portends.
Frank, this was initially reported as an altercation between two people on a bus in Vancouver. The attacker boarded the bus actually by showing a knife. And so this was very clear from the beginning that he was not just trying to ride the bus. What was initially reported was that he got into a fight and a man was stabbed on the bus. It later came out from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police that this was an ISIS operative, which is something that is unusual for them to state out up front. And so there must be considerable evidence of it, that he stabbed the man in the neck and stabbed another person as well. And the stabbing in the neck is significant because that is what the Quran directs in chapter 47, verse 4, when you meet the unbelievers, strike the necks. And so it suggests that this is somebody who was on a religious mission. The idea that ISIS would be present in Canada and in North America in general, I think most people would be surprised about, but they have been placing their people here for some years and indeed exhorting them to carry out attacks just like this one. Lone wolf attacks, as they're called, where a random person is attacked in a public place.
And Robert, to the extent that, as is often the case, we've been led to believe that it was just an altercation, I guess there is some credit to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police for stepping up and saying, well, no, it does look like jihad. Have I got that right? That as opposed to, say, the FBI in our country, which insists on obscuring wherever it possibly can, these kinds of well, fact patterns, shall we say, that you're getting a little bit more clarity out of the Canadians. And as you say, that there are obvious implications for us, not least of which is, who knows how many of these guys have been infiltrated into our country as well, and at what point will they begin to respond to the kind of directions and encouragement that they're getting from, you know, ISIS HQ?
Yeah, you know, there were 120,000 Afghans just recently resettled in the United States. And we should bear in mind that Alejandro Mayorkas, the director of Homeland Security, admitted that the vast majority of these people were not holders of special immigrant visas, that is, the people who actually aided us in Afghanistan. We should remember also that ISIS has a big presence in Afghanistan, the famous ISIS-K, or the Islamic State Khorasan province. And so it's possible, indeed even likely, that among these 120,000 new settlers in the United States, there are some, and possibly many, who are ISIS members and are indeed biding their time for an attack.
But as you know better than anybody, Robert, there's not really a dime's worth of difference, as far as we're concerned, at least, as to whether they are Taliban or Al-Qaeda or Palestinian Islamic Jihad or ISIS or some other strain of jihadist, you know, organization. They are basically all imbued with this Sharia supremacist, you know, mandate, they think, from Allah, are they not? And if so, and I couldn't agree with you more about the concern about these numbers of Afghans, settled here, distributed all over the country, the majority of whom, at least as I understand it, Robert, is are unaccompanied military-aged men.
Yes.
What, as they say, could possibly go wrong?
Yeah. They could be ISIS, they could be Taliban, they could be Al-Qaeda. All three have a considerable presence in Afghanistan. They fit the demographic of members of all of those groups. And so the risk is just compounded. In connection with ISIS, it's very clear, but there's no... See, the problem is we don't know who these people are at all. There was a brisk business in Kabul toward the end in fake IDs, and the people were supposed to be checked against criminal and terrorist databases, which are necessarily incomplete to begin with, but then they weren't, that wasn't even done. And so there's any number of jihad terrorists in the country now.
Right. And this is the point. On top of the debacle of Afghanistan and the surrender that Joe Biden engineered there, on top of this pell-mell rush to bring people who we did not know and who were certainly not the people who were helping us and who fit that demographic cohort, as well as almost certainly the ideological or theocratic bent. And then on top of it, we left $85 billion worth of arms for their use as well. And one of our other guests, Sam Faddis, has pointed out that those arms seem to be now turning up in large quantities in the hands of Taliban seeking to overthrow the government of Pakistan. So this is a witch's brew of the first order. Robert, we have to take a short break. We're going to come right back with more with Robert Spencer, the driving force behind marvelous online resource, jihadwatch.org, right after this. Welcome back. Robert Spencer is in the house virtually. We're delighted always to be able to say that. He runs a really remarkable resource for all of us, jihadwatch.org. And it's not just valuable in terms of its insights into the problem that its name suggests, that of jihad and the jihadis worldwide, but also the left, which is often aligned with them and making common cause against us, the red-green axis, as we've called it. Robert, I wanted to speak to you about one aspect of this problem of the proclivity here and elsewhere to avert our gaze from some of this bad news that you recount so, you know, assiduously. In the United Kingdom, one of the manifestations of the Sharia supremacists there has, of course, been this unbelievable practice of rape gangs or grooming gangs, as they're euphemistically called. The government of Britain has been turning pretty much a blind eye to this practice for decades. We've had a guest on, Peter McIlvaney of Hearts of Oak recently, who talked about this happening on a scale that's just unimaginable. He said that maybe hundreds of thousands of young girls in the UK has been subjected to this mistreatment. What is the government of the United Kingdom doing about the problem and the perperpetrators of it?
Frank, after years of inaction and denial and obfuscation, now the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has announced that he's going to go after this problem and solve it once and for all, end this phenomenon. And he's even speaking about being upfront and honest about the ethnicity of the perpetrators, who are largely Pakistani, and that's all to the good. At the same time, no one in Britain, not Sunak and not anyone else, with the exception of a very small number of courageous truth tellers, no one is confronting the real ideological roots of this problem, which are in an understanding that the Quran allows for the seizure of infidel women and their use as sex slaves. Now, this is something that some of the rapists are on record saying, that they are acting in accord with the Quran, that they are pleasing Allah by these actions, and so on. And yet, it's bad enough in Britain now to say that they're Pakistanis. That will bring you the opprobrium of the entire media establishment. But it's completely off the table to talk about the connection with Islam. And the problem with that, it's not about demonizing Islam or Muslims. The problem is that if you don't confront the ideology that these rapists themselves have stated as their impetus and justification, then you're never actually going to get to the root of the problem or end this phenomenon.
Robert, unfortunately, this willful blindness, shall we say, is not confined to His Majesty's government any longer. It's evident also in the Vatican. You've got a piece at jihadwatch.org that I want to commend to our listeners, especially during this Holy Week, as the Catholics and other Christians mark an important period of Jesus' life. Tell us a little bit about what is going on here with respect to some historic positions of the Catholic Church with respect to jihad and the doctrine that impels it.
Frank, the Vatican has this week repudiated officially three 15th century papal bulls. A papal bull, of course, is what used to be the term for an official document from the papacy. And these were three that were written in the 1400s that encapsulate what is called the doctrine of discovery, that most Catholics have not heard of because it's not really part and never was really part of the church's teaching, but it was the justification that was given to the government of Portugal primarily and also to Spain for the conquest of the New World. Now, the various indigenous peoples groups put pressure on the Vatican. They've actually pressured the Vatican for years to repudiate these, and so Pope Francis has done so. this week. But the substance of the Three Bulls actually is about primarily not the conquest of the New World, but about resisting jihad violence that was coming in those days from the Ottoman Empire. And the repudiation of the bulls seems to be in line with the modern day Vatican's policy of dialogue and outreach toward Muslim groups, which unfortunately is never ever reciprocated on the other side. We don't see any Islamic group renouncing jihad in response to the renunciation of these three bulls. And that's the problem.
Yeah. And as you know so well, Robert, far from this being taken as an impetus for, you know, a new relationship and partnership between the faiths, it's interpreted by people of this Sharia supremacist caste as evidence of weakness and submission, is it not? And therefore encourages them to redouble their efforts to engage in the very acts of jihad that these bulls decry.
Yeah, you're quite right. As a matter of fact, the Quran says that you should not let up when you have the upper hand against the infidels. And this is the kind of thing that gives jihadis the idea that they have the upper hand, that the infidel is renouncing a part of his own heritage and history, is going more than halfway to try to accommodate Islam and Muslims. And so the jihadis don't see that as something to reciprocate. They see that as something to take advantage of.
Indeed. It's all about submission. And that, of course, is the literal meaning of the word Islam. Robert Spencer, your expertise in all these matters is so appreciated. Thank you for sharing it with us from time to time. We look forward to visiting with you in the near future. In the meantime, keep up the great work you do at jihadwatch.org. We'll talk with you soon. We'll be talking with the rest of you, I hope, next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.